talk about the latest dental technology, I guess. But they asked me to give a lecture there, you know, something that would tie in dentistry with Christianity, so that was a bit of a challenge for me. And I was kind of joking with the people who were organizing the event, and they said, well, what do you want to call it? And so I threw up this joke while I said, you know, how about the more we drill, the more we find? And they went with it. I couldn't talk them out of the title I really had for the talk. So, hey, it was a fun time. And I discovered there was a couple of dentists in our church here that were at the convention, so it was fun meeting them. But what I want to do this morning, several of you asked me a question, because, you know, yesterday I kind of gave her, or last week, I gave a report. And by the way, where am I going to be next Sunday? Kathy and I and Fuzz are going to be in Colorado Springs. And we're going to be meeting with our publisher. And the goal is to try to help our publisher see what we think is the real market for our books. Because they've been actually marketing our books for Christians to read for themselves. And we've discovered that about 90% of the books we sell are bought by Christians to give to non-Christians to help them come to Christ. And we'd really like your prayers that when we're there in Colorado Springs, we'll be able to get that message across. And it came across through us discovering that we sell twice as many books as our publisher, and that should never be. And I think it's because they got the wrong marketing strategy. So just pray that we'll be able to help them see a new marketing strategy that actually would be in line with the Navigator's ministry, which is to bring people to faith in Christ. So that's where we'll be next week. But last week when I was here, I kind of reported a little bit on what Fuzz and I did at Ohio State University. And several of you asked me questions afterwards about the event I just simply mentioned, namely where I got to address the physics department at Ohio State University. And that event was interesting. I think I can tie it in with our lesson in Job 40. And by the way, I hope you didn't forget the homework assignment I gave you in Job 40. I'll be asking you some questions this Sunday, but also with a discovery that will kind of link the two together, what happened at Ohio State and also what's going on in Job 40. Well, I figured at Ohio State in addressing the physics and astronomy departments there that they'd be aware of a lot of the things I normally give in my talks. I was going to be speaking that night at this debate forum with the atheists. On the subject of the astronomical evidences for God. So I wanted to give the physicists and astronomers something that they probably hadn't thought about. And so I kind of started off by saying, well, you know, all of you are really scrambling to get funding for your research projects. And if you know anything about national science funding for astronomy and physics, it's going up at about 1% per year. But the problem is the inflation rate for buying astronomical equipment is going up about 5 to 10% per year. And therefore, what we're seeing in terms of real dollars is a steady decline in funding. And this has been rather discouraging for the physics and astronomy community and actually explains why there's a decreasing enrollment in the graduate departments of the country. But I said, you know, there's one discipline of astronomy where the funding's not going down. In fact, it's going up exponentially. In fact, it's gone up a factor of four times in the last 5 years, and it's increasing, and it's exponentiating increase in funding. And it says it's also the only discipline in astronomy that has no data. Do you know what it is? What's the zero-data discipline that's getting exponentially increasing funding? And it's astrobiology. So then I threw out a question to the faculty that were addressed there. I said, why is this discipline that has no data, a data-free discipline, getting such enormous infusions of new funding? And none of them really had a clue. And so that was kind of where I took the talk. And so I just want to explain to you why this rather narrow and new discipline is getting so much funding. And this is, let me just push this a little bit forward here. Here we go. Okay. So the reason why it's getting all this funding is because origin of life researchers have now concluded that it's impossible to explain the origin of life on planet Earth. But the way I set it up was this. I said, you need to understand how origin of life research is done as they all get together and say, well, what do we know about the origin of life? Well, one thing we know for sure, there's no God. Given that there's no God, how do we explain the origin of life? And when they studied the origin of life on planet Earth, they came up with these three conclusions. The origin of life took place in zero time, geologically speaking. There is no primordial soup, and there's no way we can get the building blocks of life molecules oriented to be 100% left-handed or 100% right-handed. As you're probably aware, the proteins are made up of amino acids, and the amino acids come in two types, left-handed and right-handed. And in life we see here on planet Earth, everything's left-handed. And the sugars, which make up the backbones of the DNA and the RNA molecules, are all right-handed. You say, what happens if you throw a left-handed sugar in the mix? You get nothing. What happens if you throw a right-handed amino acid into the mix, just one? You get nothing. They all have to be oriented the same way, 100% right, 100% left. The problem is we can see no physical or chemical mechanism which can encourage a mixture of 50-50 proceeding towards 0-100. And the last gasp attempt was to refer to the tiny chiral mineral crystals. And there are certain crystals that you see in clay structures where if light comes in on it, it forces the chemistry to move in a purely left-handed direction or a purely right-handed direction. And about 5 years ago, scientists were really excited, saying, we've now solved the homochirality problem. Well, they really didn't, because clay structures everywhere on planet Earth have these little tiny chiral crystals, but they're thoroughly mixed up, which means you've got this microscopic crystal that forces amino acid production to be strictly left-handed, but right next to that crystal is one that sends it in the opposite direction, right-handed. So there is no crystal structure matrix anywhere in the face of the Earth that's going to favor left against right. The individual crystals will, but they're always mixed up in what's called the racemic mixture, where half of them are pushing towards left, half of them are pushing towards right, so we get nowhere. Yes. No time, no soup. Okay, this you'll see in the first part of our Origins of Life book. And I had the privilege of having Carl Sagan as a professor when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto. And his answer to the origin of life is, well, we have this planet Earth, and we know when it was young, there were no continents, it was just a vast ocean. And he says this ocean was a rich prebiotic soup. So we have this huge ocean filled with all these prebiotic molecules, and then it percolates for about a billion years. And surely with a billion years, with a soup that vast and that rich, some simple form will come out that will eventually lead to a bacterium, and that spawns the whole tree of life. Well, we now know there's zero time. We know there's zero time because there is an event in the past history of the Earth called the Late Heavy Bombardment. And it was roughly about 20,000 asteroids, 5 kilometers across or bigger, hitting the Earth in a relatively short period of time. And that bombardment caused the surface of the Earth to be transformed into a liquid magma ocean at least 200 kilometers deep. Now, you know, some origin of life researchers who were aware of this late heavy bombardment said, well, we do find primitive bacteria 2 miles down in South African coal mines. Maybe it could survive the late heavy bombardment, but we now know that the liquid magma ocean went down at least 200 kilometers and probably at least 500 kilometers. We also know that its temperature is somewhere around 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's not going to allow any life form to survive. Now, obviously, that late heavy bombardment sent the entire planet Earth into a sterilization event. And by the way, not just planet Earth. That would have happened to Mars, would have happened to Venus, would have happened to the Moon. All the inner solar system bodies were hit, although the Earth was hit the hardest of all, just because it's got the biggest gravitational signature of the inner solar system planets. It would have been heated to the greatest degree. Now, we know the date of that. And I'm not going into the details, but we actually know the cause of the late heavy bombardment. It was discovered about 3 months ago. What exactly is the cause of the late heavy bombardment? but the date is well established, 3.85 billion years ago, and it's also well established how long it would take for the peak of the late heavy bombardment to subside, where liquid water would show up again, and where rocks would cool, where they would become solid. That date is 3.80 billion years ago, and that matches the date of the oldest rocks we see on the Earth, namely some rocks in western Greenland. Now, combine that with the fact that those same western Greenland rocks tell us that life was abundant at 3.8 billion years ago. You say, how do you know that? Well, there are two kinds of carbon in the environment, carbon-12 and carbon-13, neither one of which is radioactive. But life prefers carbon-12 to carbon-13. And so when you look at carbonaceous molecules in the crust of the Earth, you can tell whether or not those molecules are postbiotic or prebiotic. If they're postbiotic, they'll have a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 than if they're prebiotic. And what geochemists have discovered is planet Earth never had any prebiotics. All the carbonaceous stuff we find has a signature of being postbiotic, the result of living organisms that have decayed. Now, in fact, it was one physicist from Romania that several years ago explained why there's no prebiotics in the face of the Earth. It's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. Oxygen is toxic to prebiotic chemistry. So there's oxygen in the Earth's environment that will put a stop to any prebiotic chemistry. But if there is no oxygen in the environment, there'll be no ozone shield in the Earth's atmosphere, which means ultraviolet radiation pours through, and that ultraviolet radiation is toxic to prebiotic chemistry. So for planet Earth, you've got a lose-lose situation for the naturalist trying to explain the origin of life. If you've got oxygen, it'll put a stop to the prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, it'll put a stop to the prebiotic chemistry. What are you left with? Well, you're left with nothing. It's either oxygen or no oxygen. In both cases, you do not have any prebiotic chemical pathways. So that explains why the chemical evidence tells us there's never been a prebiotic soup on the face of the Earth. Now, if there's no prebiotic soup and there's no time and there's no solution to the homochirality problem, then the origin of life could not possibly have happened on planet Earth. And that's what Fuzz and I heard at the Origin of Life research conferences in 1999 and 2002. They had a few sessions and immediately concluded, well, we now know life did not originate on planet Earth. But we all know that life is here on planet Earth, therefore it must have come from outer space, and that explains why astrobiology is getting hundreds of millions of dollars of funding that the other sciences are not getting. As they say, we now know for sure the origin of life happened somewhere in outer space and then got transported by some undiscovered means to planet Earth. So that's where all a lot of NASA's money is going, is to find what's up. But it's all based on the assumption, the bottom line basic assumption, we are convinced there is no God. If there is no God and life did not originate on planet Earth, it must have originated in outer space and come here. So that's the line of the logic. And because they're so persuaded that there is no God, this explains why all this funding's coming. And by the way, it's not just public funding. It's not just your tax dollars. There's a lot of private funding going into it, especially from the likes of Paul Allen. He's pouring a lot of his wealth into this whole program. Yes. Well, in terms of origin of life researchers, it's predominantly the former with only a handful of the latter. Although I must tell you, at the last Origin of Life conference, Fuzz and I were wearing our name tags, Reasons to Believe, so they all knew who we were. But about the third day, this one guy slipped a business card to Fuzz and said, read the note, I can't be seen talking to you guys. And so we read the note, and his hotel room number was there, and he says, please call me after the sessions are over. And so we discovered that he was a believer, but he said, you know, if these people ever find out I'm a believer, I'll be an outcast. He says, I'll be in trouble. So now maybe there's more than one, but I mean, all we heard was an atheist worldview perspective. and actually quite a bit of panic at the idea that they may not be able to answer this problem of the origin of life. Okay, yeah. Well, being convinced that life did not originate on planet Earth and that they can't solve the homochorality problem planet Earth, a lot of the money is being spent trying to find sources elsewhere in the universe where there may be a homochorality pathway, a naturalistic homochorality pathway. So some of the money is going there. And then a lot of the money is being spent on, well, you know, where in the universe could we get a location where the origin of life chemistry could actually operate. And then another chunk of money is being spent, well, we know that can't be very close, therefore, what are the pathways by which that stuff could be transported from the site of the building to planet Earth? Yeah, I mean, it's all theory, it's all speculation without any data, and that's why I say it's a data-free discipline. So, yet it has all this funding. But it has all the funding from a very good reason from an atheistic perspective. If you're an atheist, this is perfectly understandable why this is getting so much funding and attention. Yes. Well, let me just take you through what I shared with the physicists. I said, okay, now these problems, no time, no soup, no homochorality, will apply to all the solar system bodies. So I said, you know, a lot of the money that NASA is spending is looking for life on Mars. But the truth is that they now realize that as tough as it is here on planet Earth, it's going to be even harder on Mars. We know that the window of time has got to be briefer than it was here on planet Earth. So it's, you know, a geologic instant here. And because of the way the Martian atmosphere is set up, we can actually calculate that it's much less than even the geologic instant we can measure here on planet Earth for Mars. And the case of Europa, which has been a favorite site, maybe there's bacteria swimming in the ocean there, they now realize that the ice on Europa, at a minimum, is 20 kilometers thick. If it's 20, and it could be a lot thicker. In fact, there may not be a liquid water ocean below the ice of Europa. That's all based on the assumption that there's a gravitational heating or a tidal heating being generated from Jupiter. But the truth is, we don't know that. In fact, one of the guys presenting the paper in the 2002 conference was making this big deal about this ocean on Europa, and he was bemoaning the fact it looks like the ice is too thick. And the problem with ice being thick, if the ice is thick, the nutrients necessary for the survival of life is on the surface of Europa. And so those nutrients have to find some way to get from the surface down to the ocean. Now, if the ocean's like 1 or 2 kilometers thick, there might be cracks that allow at least some of that stuff to get down there. But if it's 20 kilometers thick, none of it can get down there. So that makes the origin of life irrelevant on Europa because the ice is just plain too thick. But still, NASA has this plan to drill a hole through the ice as thick as it is and, you know, send a little robot with a movie camera on it looking for what's, because maybe we can find something exotic there. But the whole problem, in fact, I mentioned this to the guy who presented the paper. I said, we don't even know if there's a liquid water ocean there. And there's a real cheap way to find out. All you got to do is put a satellite around Europa. And that satellite will be able to measure the orbit of Europa very accurately as it goes around Jupiter. If we know that orbit, we'll be able to determine whether it's ice all the way down to the center or whether indeed there's some slush there or liquid water. And I said, here you're talking about spending $3 billion when you could spend less than $100 million to see if it's worth even spending the $3 billion. But the problem there is it adds about 4 more years to the whole research study. You have to do that intermediary step. But that's where I think the U.S. taxpayer needs to get involved. I mean, you know, the capacity to save $3 billion by maybe taking a few extra years might be worth doing. But as far as the physicists were concerned, they quickly acceded to my conclusion, the entire solar system is a non-option for the origin of life. And by the way, NASA's still looking for what they think is indigenous life here on Mars, but the whole idea now is that this life came from some interstellar gas cloud dumped on Mars and went from Mars to the Earth. That's the pathway they're thinking. But at least they've reached the conclusion that nowhere in the solar system gives a possibility for the origin of life. and also that the best site for the origin of life beyond planet Earth, and I would agree with it, would be what they call molecular clouds. Molecular clouds, well, I mean, have you ever seen these photographs of gaseous nebula on TV? Or, in fact, when we had our star party, we looked at a few through the telescope. The Orion Nebula is a good example. Well, that's a good example of a molecular gas cloud. It's a big, dense cloud of gas and dust, and it's a place where stars form. And it's relatively cool, and because it's cool, it's loaded with carbonaceous compounds. And in fact, the list now stands at 122 different hydrocarbon-type molecules that have been discovered in these molecular clouds. And this is what's got the origin of life community excited. Wow, we've seen there's nowhere else in the universe, and in fact, this would include Earth. There's nowhere on Earth where we get such rich hydrocarbon production by natural means as in these interstellar clouds. This is why a number of astrobiologists think this is the site for the origin of life, or at least the site for the building blocks for the origin of life. However, it's a place where, although we find 122 different hydrocarbon molecules, we don't find any ammonia, and we don't find any water. Now, if you got no ammonia and no water, you got no possibility of making amino acids, the sugars, or the nucleosides. Now, what kind of caused the origin of life community to get a little bit excited is about 5 years ago, radio astronomers announced that they had found glycine in the molecular cloud that exists at the center of our galaxy. And, you know, that made me suspicious when I heard about it, because at the center of our galaxy, we got a big, nasty black hole that's pumping out a lot of radiation that would be somewhat destructive for those kinds of molecules. But one of the reasons why radio astronomers like the molecular cloud at the center of our galaxy, it's extremely massive, very dense, and very bright. So it's an easy place to find molecules if they exist there. But 2 months ago, actually it's just 1 month ago now, in the Astrophysical Journal, the radio astronomy team withdrew their claim that they had found glycine. They said, we had misidentified the spectral line. And so, as it now stands, in no molecular cloud have astronomers found a single amino acid, a single nucleoside, or any of the sugars that are relevant to the origin of life. Now, they have found a three-carbon sugar, but the sugars that are necessary for the RNA and DNA molecules are five- and six-carbon sugars. Yeah, well, the more honest reports refer to it as the discovery of glycolaldehyde. And that's really the proper name for this three-carbon sugar. It's not a true sugar. It's really a glycol. And it's the easiest of the glycolaldehydes to find. So that they have found. But as far as trying to find something relevant to the origin of life, it's got to be five- and six-carbon sugars. Right. Yeah, and again, the more honest reports that this may be the building block towards the building block. Okay? But actually, there's no easy chemical pathway to take glycolaldehyde and make a 5-carbon sugar or a 6-carbon sugar. That doesn't exist. So it's really even incorrect to say it's a building block for a building block. That's not true either. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's an enormous step in complexity to go from a 3-carbon sugar to a 5-carbon sugar. Every carbon you throw in just makes the problem exponentially worse. So even going to a 4-carbon sugar would be an enormous step. And, you know, most of these 122 things that they have found have one carbon atom in them. A couple of them have two, but mostly they're one-carbon structures. So they are finding, that's why I say these are limited hydrocarbons, and we're finding none that would qualify as building blocks. So on that basis, you would say abandon all hope. There really is nowhere in the universe where we've got anything better than the environment of the surface of the Earth. This hasn't stopped the enthusiasm of the astrobiologists. Their whole point is, well, we haven't seen any molecular clouds yet that would be producing the building blocks for life. Maybe there are some in other galaxies. We just haven't found any in our galaxy. Of course, now you've got the problem of trying to transport the stuff from another galaxy to our galaxy. And actually, I would argue that in terms of galaxies, ours is very rich in these molecular clouds. Most galaxies are much poorer than our galaxy. The only one that even comes close would be the Large Magellanic Cloud, and that's a place that's just a nearby dwarf galaxy that has already been studied, and it's no better than the ones we've seen in our own galaxy. Nevertheless, you've got some astronomers speculating, let's just not worry about this problem, and we haven't found a place where any of these building blocks are made. Let's just assume there's someplace out there. Well, if you assume there's someplace out there, you run into what's called a transport problem. And the whole idea is that maybe you've got these dust particles, and embedded in these dust particles would be amino acids, nucleosides, and the sugars. And incidentally, that doesn't really help you much. You can have all these building blocks you want. The real challenge is to make proteins, DNA, and RNA. And no one has yet been able to make any of these proteins, DNA, and RNA in the lab. I mean, this is what researchers have been trying to do. They take all the amino acids that they know are necessary, then they try to link them together to make simple proteins. And everything gets stymied at about 40 amino acids. And the simplest protein has 100. And your typical proteins have thousands. Your really complex proteins have more than 10,000. And we can't get past the 40 amino acid barrier. That's also true of the RNA and the DNA, is that you get up to about 40 isomers, and then everything just blocks. And the problem here is just like we just discussed with the carbon. If you're taking nucleosides and then linking them together to try to make a very primitive slice or piece of RNA or DNA, what you discover is it's quite difficult to take two and put them together to make a 2-2 nucleoside chain. If you want to put three together, to put three together is exponentially more difficult than to put two. And to put four together is exponentially more difficult than to put three. Well, you don't have to be a mathematician to realize that eventually you're going to run out of money and run out of technical lab equipment to get you going. And so when they get 40 is where they pushed it, but nobody's going to get it past 40. And the understanding is trying to push past 40, you're looking at virtually infinite resources to pull that off. But nevertheless, even if you're going to say that there's a God out there that miraculously made all these proteins and DNA and RNA, what we know from the astronomy is it can't move across interstellar space without being destroyed. As it goes across interstellar space, the dust will be exposed to X-ray and ultraviolet radiation. And that radiation will break down the molecules into useless forms. In fact, it will break it down into things even simpler than the building blocks. The other thing that will cause it to break down is time. Even if there's no radiation, if you put a whole bunch of these molecules out there, time by itself will cause them to degrade. Okay, how does that work? It's just simple thermodynamics. You know what happens when you put a car in the backyard and leave it there for 50 years? It decays. Well, the same thing is true of RNA, DNA, and proteins. You just leave it all by itself, even under benign conditions, it will decay. What kind of transport times we're looking at? Well, even if we're talking nearby planetary systems, we're looking at transport times that at least must exceed 10 million years and could easily be in the billions of years. 10 million years is optimistic. That just means you get this lucky blast of radiation that sends us such particles at a straight line path right to planet Earth. But typically that's not how it works. It kind of meanders back and forth and zigzags this way, in which case you're looking more like at a billion years. And by the way, if you give it too much energy to send it on a fast pathway to planet Earth, that energy will break down all the molecules. And then once you reach planet Earth, what's going to happen? That dust particle's got to go through the Earth's atmosphere. And it goes through the Earth's atmosphere, burns up, and that breaks down all the molecules. Now, this explains why when we recover meteorites, there was a lot of enthusiasm because they would recover these meteorites, these carbonaceous meteorites, and they would find amino acids in it. I said, there's got to be something wrong with all this math that the astrophysicists have done, because look at these amino acids we have in the meteorites. Well, we now know that those amino acids are all contaminants from Earth life. And what the astronomy community wasn't aware of is just how quickly a meteorite gets contaminated by Earth life when it hits the surface. In fact, there was a meteorite that was recovered on a frozen lake in Canada. The meteorite dropped in the middle of winter. The lake was frozen. It was called Tagish Lake up in northern British Columbia. And they recovered that thing within a few days after it landed. Well, within those few days, it was thoroughly contaminated by the amino acids in the vicinity of Lake Tagish, which is why there's actually a move on the part of NASA to grab one of these comets while still up there in interplanetary space. In fact, the joke at the last conference was, the only way we're really going to know what exists inside these meteorites that's important for the origin of life is to catch one before it lands. But actually, even that's not true. As it goes through the atmosphere, it gets contaminated. And so NASA now has a plan to grab one of these comets while it's still orbiting around the solar system, long ways from the Earth's atmosphere. I think that mission is due in 2006. They're going to send a rocket out there, go to one of these comets, grab a piece of the comet, and bring it back. Piece of the comet and bring it back to Earth for analysis. But I'd be willing to predict that when they do that, they're not going to find any amino acids or nucleosides or anything relevant to sugars, just based on what we know here. We already know that they can't be made in these interstellar clouds. And that's really what a comet is, by the way. A comet is simply compressed interstellar gas and dust. And so you're just looking at compressed comet cloud material, and we already know what exists in these comet clouds, not compressed. Therefore, that's another place where NASA could save some money. Instead of looking for amino acids in a comet, now let's just go to the interstellar clouds. You already know it's not there. Since you know it's not there, why bother grabbing a piece of the comet? That's kind of a cynic way to look at it. A more positive way to look at it is it's worth getting a piece of comet regardless of whether it contains any molecules that are could possibly can be construed as the building blocks of life. Yeah. You're going to have to speak a little. I can't quite hear you. Yeah, another contamination issue. He says, you know, how can... Yeah, the question he asked is, well, we're talking about how a comet or a meteorite gets contaminated by Earth life, the amino acids in Earth life when it hits the ground. And he says, well, here we got NASA taking a spaceship to grab a piece of the comet. Who's to guarantee that the spaceship won't contaminate the little sample? And well, what NASA tries to do is very carefully sterilize their spaceships before they send them up. But you can, I think JPL is actually having an open house sometime in the next week or two, this weekend. And so you can go there and talk to them. And they will admit that there's really no guarantee that they can completely sterilize things. I mean, they do the best they can. In fact, that's a major concern about going to Mars, is that no matter how careful we are on cleaning the craft, if there's people on board, when they get to Mars, they're going to contaminate the place. And, you know, we're going to start drawing conclusions about the remains of life on Mars when it may be just the dandruff left over from the asteroid or the astronauts. So you've got to be very careful. But it's a little easier when you're sending an unmanned mission. You can just blast the thing with radiation inside and out before you send it up. But make sure nobody handles the thing by the time it gets on the launch pad. And the other problem is we already know that meteorites get at least partly contaminated going through the atmosphere. If the rocket ship is sitting on the pad getting ready for launch, even then there's a possibility for some contamination. So the answer to your question is there's no absolute guarantee, but you can minimize the risk by being very careful to clean things and sterilize things before they go up. Well, the astronomical community, in seriously dealing with this transport problem, has figured out, well, we're talking molecules or bacteria embedded inside dust grains. The dust grain's not going to be adequate to protect the material from the X-ray and ultraviolet radiation. So what we're going to suggest is that it comes inside a rock. And there was an astronomer that calculated how big a rock you would need to adequately protect a bacterium inside that rock from the outside radiation. The answer is 2 meters thick with no cracks. Now, you know, when you look at meteorites, they're rather heavily fractured. But if you're lucky enough to have a compound that has no cracks in it and it's 2 meters in diameter, and you put the bacterium square in the middle of that 2 meter diameter space rock, then it will be protected from the ultraviolet radiation and the X-ray radiation. But it raises two questions. If the thing is not porous and has no cracks, how does the bacterium get in the middle of that rock? Okay, but you know, how would it get out? How would it get in? So that's an issue. And the other issue is it does not solve the transport time problem. Okay, if this thing is taking tens of millions or a billion years to go through interstellar space, that doesn't matter whether it's inside a dust grain or a gigantic boulder, it still will decay just through the second law of thermodynamics. Nevertheless, a lot of money was spent just trying to figure out, well, how many rocks does the solar system get from other planetary systems? Well, what one astronomer did, Jay Melosh, is he said, let's just assume that our galaxy is loaded with planetary systems, all of them packed with life as densely as the Earth is. Okay, and let's also assume that these planetary systems are like ours, and they're loaded with meteorites and comets that are pounding into all these planets that are loaded up with life. And then he tried to determine how many rocks our solar system would receive from some neighboring planetary system. And they didn't worry about 2 meters in diameter. Those kinds of rocks are rather rare. In order to be as optimistic as possible, they said, let's just work with rocks the size of a human fist or bigger. Here's the answer he came up with. We get, at best, one such rock every 10 to 16 years. Okay, and that's a million times older than the age of the universe. So the bottom line conclusion is, we did not get light sent here inside a rock. There just aren't enough rocks coming our way, certainly not the big ones. And so that kind of really put a whole damper on origin of life research, which caused, at the last Origin of Life Research Conference, one scientist came forward and said, let me just review. This is on the last day of the conference. Let me review for you what we've accomplished at this conference. Number one, in the first hour of the conference, we eliminated planet Earth as a contender. And then we spent the next day and a half eliminating the solar system as a contender. Then we spent the next 2 days eliminating these interstellar clouds and any transport mechanism. Now, the one thing we haven't discussed, and is really the only possible answer that's left, is aliens must have come here in spaceships and planted life here on planet Earth. But this raises two questions. If you're going to say that aliens brought life here to planet Earth, and by the way, the guy was really excited about this, and it's not new. This goes all the way back to Francis Crick. Francis Crick, the Nobel laureate on the double helix of DNA and RNA, wrote a book in 1981 where he actually predicted that the Origin of Life research community would run into all these problems. And Francis Crick, like the rest of them, was an atheist, and so he wrote this book in 1981 where he concluded that the answer to the origin of life on planet Earth is intelligent aliens sending a spaceship here. But the guy at the conference, he says, you know, this is also exciting from a second perspective. Because not only the origin of life that we're struggling to explain all these mass speciation events. And he listed them. You got the Cambrian explosion. You got the big speciation event after the Permian extinction that wiped out 95% of all species of life on planet Earth. And so, truth be told, we have at least 8 of these mass extinction events followed by mass speciation events. And so his solution to the problem was to say the aliens came back 8 times. Okay, they came here 3.8 billion years ago, and they came after all the mass extinction events. And he says it's a zoo hypothesis. When the zoo animals all get killed, you have to go out and get more animals and put them back in the cages. And he says that's what they've been doing here on planet Earth. But it raised two questions. How do you explain the origin of the aliens? Wouldn't they be under the same problems as the origin of life here on planet Earth? I mean, where else can you go in the universe and find a better situation for a naturalistic origin of life on planet Earth? The answer is you can't. So this begs the question. We can't explain the origin of the aliens. And then a comment that I was able to make and it's in our Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men book. Even if you were to pause it, and because they knew we were Christians, and they said, well, you know, you guys, you could potentially believe in aliens, because after all, you don't need a naturalistic pathway. You can just invoke your God to create aliens somewhere else, and then those aliens could be endowed by God with the capacity to send spaceships here and bring life. So they said, it can't be a problem for you. I said, well, it's still a problem in the sense that the laws of physics would not permit some God-created alien on another planetary system to traverse interstellar space to bring life here. I mean, the laws of physics, as we explained in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, simply will not allow you to traverse those distances in the required time without killing the life that's on board. Now, if all you want to send is iron chips, that's one thing, but if you want to send something like RNA, DNA, and proteins, or better yet, a bacterium, then there's no way that spaceship can be protected from the rigors. And there's two problems. You either have to deal with the radiation problem. You've got to build a really heavy spaceship that's got several feet of lead protection to block out the radiation. But now you're looking at a lot of energy to move across interstellar space. And then the longer you take to move across interstellar space, the more quickly it'll break down. And if you move too fast through interstellar space, trying to cut down the time, what that does is destroys the spaceship. Because you bump into stuff. And you're bumping into stuff at half the velocity of light that will disintegrate your spacecraft. You've got to go a lot slower. So, and by the way, Origin of Life researchers in the year 2004 have owned up to the fact that directed panspermia is not a solution. So what are they doing now? Well, this brings me up to a brand new discovery. This just got published in the last issue of the Astrobiology magazine, and it was published by two of the world's leading astrobiologists. One of them you've probably heard of, Paul Davies. He won the Templeton Prize a few years back, and he was joined by Charles Lineweaver. And these are two of the world's most prominent astrobiologists. Both of them are physicists, but they've been attending these meetings. And so how they argue in this paper, just published a couple of weeks ago, is to make the point, well, one thing we know about the origin of life, it happened in a near instant 3.8 billion years ago, and it happened without the benefit of a primordial soup. Therefore, the origin of life has got to be incredibly easy as a pathway. Given that it's extremely easy, it must have happened multiple times on planet Earth. So they argue in the paper that if we really dig deep into the fossil record, we should find multiple evidences for independent origins of life, because after all, we know it's got to be so easy. And if it happened in an instant 3.8 billion years ago, it must have happened thousands of times thereafter. In fact, it should be happening today. And they're actually encouraging scientists to go out into the field and to look for new origins of life just popping up everywhere. And on that basis, they're concluding that the answer to the origin of life, because we can't find a chemical pathway that makes it work, is to say it's due to a hidden law of physics. There's some new law of physics out there that no one has yet discovered that spontaneously takes disorganized matter and organizes it, giving a high degree of order and complexity, and this is going on all over the universe. Yeah. Well, that's kind of the point I'm driving here. You're left with two options. There's a hidden law of physics, or it's not a hidden law, it's a transcendent, supernatural, superintelligent being that's responsible for all of this. And the problem with this hidden law that they're appealing to is it's a law that would spontaneously take disordered, decayed matter and transform it to highly informative matter complexity if you just leave it alone. The example I gave earlier, you take an old car, put it in the backyard for 50 years, what happens to the car? It does not get all fixed up. I mean, if you just leave that car in the backyard, you'll find that the repair job becomes more difficult, not less difficult, with respect to time. And this is actually admitted by the primary proponent of this explanation for the origin of life, the atheist Stuart Kaufman at the Santa Fe Institute. In fact, he refers to this hidden law of physics as the fourth law of